You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. I have the distinct privilege today of speaking with Congressman Seth Moulton and Congressman Jim Banks of the House Armed Services Committee to talk about their just finished report, which they were asked to do with a small group of other congressmen and congresswomen by the ranking member, Congressman Chairman Smith, as well as the ranking member, Mac Thornberry, to look at the future of defense in the United States and give a congressional perspective on this weighty topic that the country has been focused on so much. I also think it's a nice opportunity on September 30th to see a little bit of bipartisanship return to the public discussion in the United States after a week where we haven't always seen a lot of that. But I think I also want to commend these two young congressmen who have already been remarkable in their accomplishments on Capitol Hill in their fairly brief congressional careers, but also they both served in the military. I first met Seth Moulton in Iraq in 2007 when he was a Marine who was activated to serve there. And Congressman Banks has been part of the Navy Reserve. He hails from the great Hoosier state of Indiana. And as a resident or original resident of Western New York State, I like those Midwestern sensibilities. Seth Moulton, of course, comes from Massachusetts, one of the great early colonies and states in the United States, so crucial in the Revolutionary War and every other American national security matter since. So I could not imagine two better individuals to lead this discussion today. We have 1 hour. We will use the latter part of the discussion time for your questions. But let me first invite each of the congressmen, starting with Congressman Moulton, to explain a little bit about the genesis of this report, just in very broad terms, what you're trying to achieve with it. And then I'll have some specific follow-up questions on a number of the main provisions, findings, and recommendations. So, gentlemen, thank you for joining me today. And Congressman Moulton, over to you first, my friend.
Sure. Well, Mike, thank you very much for having us on. It's an honor to be here and an honor to be here with my friend and colleague and fellow veteran, Jim Banks. I wasn't exactly anticipating how you would introduce us, but I'm definitely the revolutionary guy, I guess, from Massachusetts. He's the man with a Midwestern sensibility. But there's a sense in which this report really strikes the balance of both. We're calling for a real revolution in how we approach our national security. And we're saying that unless the Department of Defense seriously undertakes a revolution, makes some dramatic changes to how we secure our country, we will not be secure. We will lose the race to Russia, to China. In fact, in some places, they're already beating us. But at the same time, I think our report is very grounded. It is sensible. It is fully bipartisan, which, as you note, is a remarkable achievement in today's world. Usually when you set up a committee like this, it's set up like any committee in Congress where, yes, there are bipartisan members, but there are more members from the majority than from the minority. So in this case, since Democrats control the House, it would be more Democrats on the committee than Republicans. But instead, this task force was completely bipartisan. Four Democrats, four Republicans. We all had to agree on our findings, our recommendations. We travel around the world, around America, to understand what's really going on and what the real threats are that we face. And we came to a remarkable consensus that is serious and game-changing, but also fully bipartisan. One of the things that we were able to do is really get into the details of how we're looking at these challenges that face the country in a way that takes a much longer-term view than we usually do on the Armed Services Committee. We're very proud that every single year we pass a defense bill, again, a bipartisan achievement, but it funds the Department of Defense for the next 12 months. As a result, we sort of have this necessary look at the horizon 1 year out. And what we did with this task force is we took the chairman and the ranking member's mandate to look about 30 years out to say, what do we need to do to prepare for the true challenges of the future? And it turns out we need to do a lot that we're not doing today. So we'll get into all those details, but that's kind of where we started. And thank you so much for having us here this morning.
That's fantastic. Congressman Banks, over to you for your framing thoughts, please. And welcome again.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you to the Brookings Institute for doing this. This is the first joint appearance by Seth and I, truly explaining the report as it was just announced yesterday. We appreciate you giving us a platform to do that. And Seth, let me formally thank you for the opportunity to work with you in this partnership to dive into what I believe is just the beginning. We released the report yesterday, but I believe that Seth and I likely will dedicate the rest of our careers in Congress to tackling the findings of this report. It's just that important. I recall back to the very first hearing that we held in the Armed Services Committee hearing room at the outset of this task force. We heard from Senator Jim Talent on our side and others talking about sort of setting the stage for Michelle Flournoy on the Democrat side, two outstanding speakers to set the stage for this report. And one of the key takeaways that stuck with me to this point today, at the day after the release of the final report, is that we need a new attitude in the Pentagon that is far less risk averse. We need to take risk, support risk, and understand that sometimes when we take risk, our bets might fail, but we have to restore an attitude at the Pentagon that fosters innovation through allowing for risk. And that starts with our side of the equation at the Capitol on the Armed Services Committee. Seth and I need to be the types of leaders to help set the stage in the Congress to support the Pentagon to foster that attitude, to pat them on the back and understand that sometimes some of those risks might not turn out the way that we want, but if we're going to be less risk averse, Congress needs to take a posture of patting the Pentagon on the back when it comes to that. We've also determined that what we need is a new Sputnik moment, and we talk about this in the report. We need a race, especially when it comes to our strategic competition with China and Russia, a Sputnik moment, an opportunity to a competition with those two countries, especially when it comes to innovation and emerging technologies related to national defense. And we unpack that significantly, how we can get there in this report. So there are a lot of other items that we tackle, from fostering the type of talent that we need domestically through legislative efforts to increase the STEM skills of American students to foster this type of innovation, and also better partnerships with Silicon Valley, with innovators around the country to foster the type of technology and innovation that we need to compete with China and Russia as well. I remember back to 2017, I was a brand new freshman member of Congress, and the National Defense Strategy historically called for a change from the posture of the last two decades of being focused on important national defense issues related to terrorism. But what the National Defense Strategy called for, a change from that mindset to our strategic competition with China and Russia, I see the Future of Defense Task Force report falling very much in line with fulfilling the mission of the 2017 National Defense Strategy that identified Russia and China as our strategic competitors that we need to be focused on far more than what we've been focused on in the last several decades. So we're very proud of this report. We're proud of the staff effort that was behind it. Like Seth said already, this was a truly bipartisan effort. Scott Desjarlais from Tennessee, Mike Waltz from Florida, myself and Paul Mitchell from Michigan were the four Republicans who participated in this effort. All of them made valuable contributions, and we're proud to talk more about our findings and some of our suggestions in the rest of the hour that we have ahead of us. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think the natural next question, and Congressman Banks, you sort of alluded to it already, is how this report and your vision relate to the National Defense Strategy. Because if we look over the last 10 years, we've seen a gradual shift in, I think, some of the same direction that you're talking about, starting with the Obama administration's rebalance to the Asia Pacific, which was not just a defense strategy, but wanted to prioritize China more. And then we saw the so-called third offset, which was sort of the last big idea from the Obama Pentagon, talking about reinvigorating conventional deterrence. That became sort of the, in some ways, some of the intellectual backdrop to Jim Mattis's national defense strategy with the emphasis on China and Russia. So we've been seeing a shift in this direction. So to what extent do you see your vision as complementing the national defense strategy, or just sort of, as you say, giving a pat on the back to those who support it? To what extent do you think that there are new big ideas that actually are somewhat different from the national defense strategy? And of course, we can get into some of those in detail. But do you see this primarily in terms of continuity with the national defense strategy of 2018, or do you see this as a major departure? And the related question, of course, is what's happened since the NDS was released. And I can think of at least two big things. One is COVID, and the other is the flattening of projected U.S. defense budgets. Even the Trump administration's own projections from last winter no longer anticipated the kind of real growth of 3% to 5% per year that the National Defense Strategy had originally called for, that the National Defense Strategy Commission, the bipartisan group following it up, had called for. We don't have those kinds of budgetary aspirations in most quarters any longer. So how do we fulfill the vision of the NDS with much less money? Congressman Moulton, maybe again you could start, and then I'll come back to Congressman Banks.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think it is absolutely consistent with the national defense strategy. It's certainly consistent in identifying what we see as the key threats. We say right in our very first finding that Russia presents the most immediate threat to the United States, but its long-term economic forecast is not too positive. And so we recognize that China represents the most significant both economic and national security threat to the United States over the next 20 to 30 years. And that's very consistent with what's laid out in the National Defense Strategy. Where I would say we diverge is in saying that we need to make much more dramatic changes to how we're addressing these threats in order to truly meet them, in order to keep up with the revolution that I think China and Russia are really undertaking in how they fund their national security, what sorts of technologies they're investing in, how they see themselves meeting the challenge of the United States. I also think that our report is quite consistent or quite robust in terms of how it anticipates these challenges. We started before COVID, so we did not know that that was coming. We did not know that defense budgets would be flattened. But what we're saying is that we face a new world of threats. And we do emphasize biotech, although I would hasten to say that it's not in just a traditional way where we're talking about sort of bioweapons. We're actually talking about biotech as a technology that can actually be used to manufacture things and could literally be a producer of national security items in the future. So it's taking a very long-term view towards the role of biotechnology in our society. But it's also saying that part of what we need to do is divest of old, expensive, heavy legacy weapon systems. And only by doing that can we have the budgetary freedom to invest in these new technologies. And that's going to be just all the more necessary as we are facing the kinds of deficits that this economic downturn because of COVID has brought on.
Thank you. Congressman Banks, over to you.
In so many ways, our report is a wake-up call. 2017, at this point, feels like a long time ago, right? We've been through a lot in 4 years. And in many ways, our report builds upon the National Defense Strategy. We call for additional research and additional defense spending that aligns with the NDS. But I think what we find, what Seth and I found throughout this effort, was the NDS 2017 laid the groundwork, and we've done too little in 4 years to foster the type of attitude at the Pentagon that it's going to take to develop the environment that fosters innovation. What do I mean by that? I think it's clear the finding of the reports show we need greater innovation in artificial intelligence, AI in the air, at sea, surface, underwater, space. Where is that technology coming from? Much of it is fostered in the commercial market. And what we heard over and over and over again from our partners in the private sector is that the barriers to innovation at the Pentagon prevent the same type of innovation occurring in the United States that's occurring in China, Russia, and elsewhere. So how do we break it away? We understand the acquisition system at the Department of Defense is entirely broken. We need to fix it, and we lay out some specific items in our report that gives some suggestions on how we can do that.
So let me follow up on the theme of money and resources, because on the one hand, we've heard people like Chris Brose, who testified before your panel, the former McCain staffer and very smart and thoughtful strategist, as well as Kath Hicks at CSIS. They've talked about how much money is needed to do the sorts of things that you're proposing. And sometimes the price tag, while it's big, is not astronomical, at least by Pentagon standards. They're talking about 5% of the Pentagon budget. If we could reorient 5%, that would allow for a lot of what you're talking about, a lot of the priorities. On the other hand, and again, no one can foresee what is going to happen in 2021, 2022 with the budget, but it doesn't look very rosy for those who thought we needed 3-5% real growth, and probably 0% real growth is a more realistic expectation. So where's the money going to come from? You know, even if it only is a few percent of that defense budget, specifically, do you think that if we had to make a choice, are we, and this builds on some of the questions that are already coming in from the audience, are we going to have to either retire some platforms, stop building things like F-35s and M1 tanks, legacy systems, as they're called, or cut force structure? I assume neither of you is in favor of cutting military pay or benefits, so I'm assuming that we might have to get smaller. Or again, divest from legacy systems to the extent you can be specific about where some of the money is going to come from. I think that could be helpful, even though you may not yet have reached a consensus on that. And the last possibility, of course, is efficiency, which we all like to talk about, base closures, healthcare reform, acquisition reform, et cetera. The report talks about some of those things, but we know those kinds of savings tend to only accrue gradually. So I'm wondering, where does the rubber meet the road in terms of protecting resources for the innovation that your report emphasizes so centrally? Congressman Moulton, and then back to Congressman Banks.
Sure. No, oh, absolutely. I mean, look, this is a fair question. We made a conscious decision early in this task force to not get into specific weapons systems, legacy platforms, whatever they may be, that we felt need to be cut. A lot of members of the task force have our own pet, projects, our own things that we think really need to go. And we considered calling out some of those specifically. But what we instead recommended is that an outside organization, this is actually our fourth recommendation in the report, have a commission that stood up like, led by the RAND Corporation or some similar agency, to study legacy platforms within the Department of Defense and determine their relevance and their resiliency to emerging threats over the next 50 years. And they should look at everything from how services are organized down to specific weapon systems and specific future programs that that we're investing in. And they need to say that, look, we cannot afford to be spending all this money on platforms that are easy to defeat by emerging technologies when we have to invest much more in these emerging technologies themselves. So if you look at our recommendations, the number one recommendation is not to spend a mere single percentage digit amount of money on AI. It's to literally have a Manhattan Project scale effort to lead the world in artificial intelligence. That's our first recommendation. That's a lot of money. That's a big shift. That's saying that we need to dramatically change course at the Department of Defense with the structure and the amount in our budgets. But then you only have to get down to recommendation number four before you say, in order to do that, we're going to have to make some cuts to the existing structure. But rather than just think about this in terms of numbers and how we can save money by, for example, cutting end strength, what we need to think about is, what does our force look like to truly meet these new threats? I'll give you an example. We probably need to have a lot more cyber warriors engaged in the Department of Defense. I suspect that that will mean we have to raise pay and benefits to make sure that we can attract and retain that talented workforce. So actually, in some places, we're going to say we need to spend a lot more money on certain things. But we also need to make smart cuts to technologies that are just outdated and that ultimately hurt our national security because we're spending so much time and effort and money to maintain them and to sustain them that we're not able to focus on where the real threats lie.
Thank you. Congressman Banks, to you, please.
Yeah, as Seth said, I'm fully convinced this is a lot less about spending more money and a lot more about forcing the Pentagon's hand to develop that mindset and attitude of fostering the type of innovation that we need. And if you go to the very first, as Seth already referred to, our very first recommendation is that we would require every major defense acquisition program to evaluate at least one AI or autonomous alternative prior to funding. That's how we forced the Pentagon's hand to take on an entirely different mindset than the one that they have currently that crushes the type of innovation that we need. So we go on and we talk about requiring the very next recommendation is require all major defense acquisition programs to be AI ready and nest with existing and planned joint all domain command and control networks. That's the second recommendation that we make. So these are recommendations that aren't going to cost the department more resources, but it changes the mindset to foster the attitude that it's going to take to innovate. What we also did, what Seth and I also did along with our task force, is we spent a lot of time studying programs within the department that already exists, like AFWERX, and we visited Kessel Run and that the Air Force runs in Boston, DIUX, DARPA, the new Cyber Command, Space Command, the JAIC. These are programs that exist, and these are programs that we do believe if they had additional resources, they could do even more to foster this type of innovative mindset that the Pentagon needs to take on from here to get to where we need to be.
You know, Kessel Run is a great example, Mike, of something like this. I mean, Kessel Run was not founded in the Air Force to save money. It was founded to increase the speed of innovation. It said, we can bring some of this innovation in-house. We can develop a better parts maintenance database system for the F-35 if we just hire some really smart people who are really close to the operators and do it within the Air Force, as opposed to having the big defense contractor, which has been failing repeatedly to get a good system, do it themselves. The result is a much better parts and maintenance inventory for the F-35. But a side benefit of it is that it's saved a lot of money. And I think that that's what we're going to find with a lot of these innovations. Many of these new technologies are cheaper. And actually, that's one of the things that's given China and Russia an advantage over us in the past few years, because as they're investing in these technologies to just sort of leapfrog what we have, they've been able to do it while spending less money, which is ultimately helpful to their whole, you know, to their whole nation. They're not trying to match the number of aircraft carriers that we have. They're not saying, okay, the United States has 13 or 14 aircraft carriers, therefore we need to have 15 or 16 that have the exact same capabilities. They're just developing weapons to defeat ours. They're just developing missiles that cost less than 1/1,000th the cost of a U.S. aircraft carrier that can sink one. So it's interesting where actually taking the lower cost approach, given the changing nature of technology, it in some ways gives you an awful lot of advantages. And oh, by the way, that saves money not only to invest in more of these AI-enabled weapon systems, more of these future technologies, more quantum computers. It also means you have more money to invest in things like education that we've known since the 1950s are so critical to our leadership in national security.
You know, that's very helpful. And one of the things I like about your report is it doesn't just list the 8 or 10 top technologies that we all hear people, you know, sort of the new thing in Washington. If you're in defense, you mentioned hypersonics, you mentioned directed energy, small satellites, obviously AI, quantum computing. All those things are in your report. But if I understand correctly, Congressman Banks, there's an extra emphasis on AI, and including in the way you just said. But am I correct that your task force, including all the people you mentioned, I might give a shout out to Congresswoman Slotkin and Davis and Houlihan. I think that completes the group of eight, in addition to you two and the other Republicans that you mentioned a minute ago, Congressman Banks. But am I right that AI really gets extra emphasis in your report. And could you explain a little more about that, please?
Yeah, I believe that's very accurate. It's not the only recommendation that we make, but it's an important and powerful recommendation that we make, because to compete with China, especially, and with Russia, greater AI capabilities are a must to get there. And we give specific recommendations on how we can do it. But Michael, the way you framed it, yes, it does get extra emphasis as we change the acquisitions systems and the bureaucratic mindset, the Pentagon that prevents us from fostering the type of innovation that we need in AI. That's a bottom line key finding that we make in the report.
So a couple of questions about restructuring the Pentagon. You both talk, and all eight of you talk about the need to continue to build on these innovative concepts like DIUX, to use acquisition authorities that already exist but frequently are not invoked by the Pentagon, to try to reach out to Silicon Valley companies that currently aren't part of the national security ecosystem, so to speak. Are there any structural reforms to the Department of Defense that you think are needed to codify or to promote these sorts of things? Or do you think we have a structure that's already adequate if we would simply utilize the authorities that already exist and then sort of shake ourselves up as to what new big ideas we have to pursue? Again, I'm building partly on the questions that are coming in from the audience when I pose that question. So is there a need for structural reform at the Department of Defense? Congressman Moulton, over to you.
I mean, I think arguably there is, but it depends on what kind of structural reform you're talking about. So what you see the Commandant of the Marine Corps doing right now, where he's fundamentally questioning all the assumptions that underlie the Marine Corps' mission and the types of investments they make to sustain and make sure they win at that mission, that absolutely needs to happen. And that probably is going to lead to some structural reform in the Marine Corps. Not only in what platforms they have, but in what types of people they're recruiting, how their units are actually structured. What we're not saying is that we necessarily have to completely rethink the Department of Defense and get away with, do away with this service or that service or something like that. But one of the early comments that I've received just in the last, less than 24 hours since we published this report, is people saying that, this is fantastic. In order to actually implement this, we're going to need to talk about a 2021, 2022 version of Goldwater Nichols, where we're willing to really push the department to make these types of reforms in ways like Jim just outlined with regards to artificial intelligence, where, look, if they were doing this on their own, and by the way, it's not just DOD here, it's Congress as well, right? We're like the board of directors for DOD, and we ultimately determine their funding. So if we could say if Congress and DOD together were already doing this, then there would be no need for this task force, or at least our conclusion would have been simply, hey, we're good, no need to worry. Instead, our conclusions are we have a lot to worry about, and we do need to make some changes. And Jim made a very strong statement in his opening remarks that he thinks that that he and I will devote the rest of our careers in Congress to ensuring that these changes are made. You know, Jim, you're right. This is that big and it's that important. And it's absolutely what I want to do. And I'm glad to have a good partner in that effort. But it's going to take a lot of work and it is going to take some significant change.
So Congressman Banks, you may want to comment in that same vein, but I also wanted to give you the invitation to speak about your service the same way that Seth Moulton just spoke about his. Since you're from the Navy. And one of the ideas in the report, I think you quote Michelle Flournoy saying, maybe we need one fewer carrier, but more unmanned systems in the Navy, or maybe some long range unmanned combat aircraft flying off of whatever number of carriers we have so that we can stay a little further away from those regions where carriers are vulnerable and still make them effective as combat instruments. Is there any specific recommendation for the Navy that you would really want to highlight coming out of the report?
Yeah, well, Seth, I apologize. I didn't mean to assign the mission of your future career in Congress, but
that's okay. You were right.
but I am very proud of this report and very proud of what we've come up together. And I do think it provides a framework. And what I found 4 years in Congress and through this effort is Seth and I are up against a attitudinal barrier at the Pentagon that prevents the type of innovation that we need. I mean, that's the bottom line here is this isn't, you ask about structural reforms to the department. This is far more attitudinal and far less structural. I mean, if the department utilized the authorizations that they already have that grants them the type of flexibility that already exists, they could foster the type of innovation that it's going to take to compete with China, Russia, other strategic competitors and adversaries that we face, where the future of warfare will become that much more important. You talk about the United States Navy, and the future of war is going to be fought with autonomous surface ships, autonomous underwater drones, autonomous planes, fighter jets in the sky. Yet the attitude within the Department of the Navy, the Air Force, is very much in contradiction to what Seth and I have determined through our efforts in developing this report. That's the sad reality. That's what we're fighting against. And that's why I think this will be a career fight to take on the types of reforms that are needed to get there. So I think I'll leave it at that. But I do think this is far more, just to summarize, far more attitudinal and far less structural.
So let me now get a couple of the other specifics. And again, I'm building on audience questions as I do this too. But one of the big ideas in your report is about supply chains. And I really liked this because I thought you tried to push the debate to a new level. We know that we've been thinking a lot more about supply chains in the last few years. And I'm not necessarily a supporter of the Trump administration, but I will give them credit for thinking harder about supply chains in regard to potential adversaries, and most explicitly China. I think this is an overdue debate, and you folks want to push that to a new level, even beyond anything the Trump administration has done so far, by talking about an intelligence capability to really examine where we have dependencies on foreign suppliers, specifically and initially within the Department of Defense, but even more broadly across the national infrastructure and our economy writ large. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about this idea. And maybe I'll put the question to both of you, because I think it's so important, starting again, Seth Moulton, with you, Congressman.
I mean, if you had asked anybody in America 8 months ago, do we have a supply chain weakness or a single point of failure when it comes to producing masks and personal protective equipment for doctors and nurses in hospitals, I don't think anyone would have raised any alarm whatsoever. And yet now we all know that that's a real problem, that we're dependent on it from China. And so that's exactly what we're talking about. It's again, very high in our recommendations. It's the third recommendation that we make, that the United States has to ensure supply chain resiliency within both the military and civilian sectors. And so, you know, under that, a specific recommendation is to form this National Supply Chain Intelligence Center. We're suggesting it go under the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, to monitor and protect these supply chain interests. I mean, this is one of these things that we've had to do during wartime. But now we recognize that it's important during peacetime as well. And if we're going to be able to survive these wars, especially when so much of this technology is only going to be exploited when war actually breaks out. What do I mean by that? If you have some vulnerability in a computer chip, the whole point would be for our adversary not to exploit that vulnerability until they really want to take advantage of it, and it catches us off guard. So this is an intelligence fight as much as it's just a fight that has to do with industrial and economic capacity. Jim, I'm sure you have more to say on this, though.
Michael, if I could go back to the previous conversation, there was something I wanted to say and I forgot to say it. When we talk about the attitudinal barriers to fostering innovation at the Pentagon, you know, it's really since Secretary Mattis and the release of the National Defense Strategy that I've heard anyone at the Pentagon seriously talk about innovation and talk about the issues that Seth and I are talking about today. How many secretaries have we had since Mattis? I mean, I can think of, two or three. I have yet to hear another secretary talk about what we are talking about today. And if I'm critical of the administration on anything, it's that when we need leadership at the Pentagon who takes this report seriously and echoes the themes and recommendations that we're making that will help us get to where we need to be. So as far as talking about supply chain issues, NDAA section 889 talks about rooting out bad or foreign malign actors like Huawei from the DoD supply chain. Yet we haven't done enough in that regard to do that as well. And that in addition to the supply chain issue, we talk about in section 3 of the recommendations of our report, we talk about strengthening apparatus like Firma or CFIUS as well to protect our critical technologies and our supply chain from malign foreign actors too. So we dig deeply into making some of those recommendations that are outside of the Pentagon's wheelhouse into these other institutions that we have that already exist to take this whole of government approach that it's going to take to not just foster innovation, but to protect it at the same time.
I wanted to get into another big idea in your report, which is the emphasis on a whole of government approach, especially for smaller scale crises, gray zone competition, nonviolent competition. This is near and dear to my heart because one of the things I've been writing about in the last couple of years is a set of scenarios where you get a probing attack. Could even be military, but maybe it's not violent. Maybe the Chinese show up on a Senkaku island claimed by Japan, but no one lives there. So they come ashore. They don't have to shoot anybody to do so. It's sort of a little green men kind of concept like Putin used in Crimea in 2014. But in this case, in the Pacific theater. And then what do? Do we really start shooting at those Chinese soldiers to drive them off a piece of land where the U.S. government doesn't even recognize whose land it should be? We don't have an opinion on whose land it should be, but we recognize Japan currently administers this. Therefore, we're sort of locked in to help Japan defend these islands. This is just one example. You talk about information warfare. You talk about cyber attacks in the sort of broader panoply of gray zone competition. And you suggest that in addition to developing better defense concepts, we also need more of a whole of government approach so that we can maybe find the right, sometimes perhaps even non-kinetic, non-lethal response. I wonder if either of you could elucidate a little bit more about that way of thinking, please.
I mean, this is so important. And it's not just the future of warfare, it's warfare today. I mean, this is the reality on the ground. You talked about meeting in Iraq. I mean, we were meeting with tribal elders and we were working with the State Department there. I recently visited a portion of Marine officer training. And one of the questions I asked the students is, you know, in all the exercises that you're doing here in 6 months, how many times have you, in your scenarios that you are playing out, how many times have you worked with the State Department? The answer was not at all. And that's interesting because I found myself working with the State Department probably practically every day on the ground in Iraq. And so that was actually a very essential skill set to have as a young Marine officer in today's world. And yet it's not something that we prepare our troops for enough. It's not something we focus on enough as a nation. It's not something that we've really gamed out in terms of our war plans enough. So the type of scenario that you just described, Mike, is not fanciful at all. It's very real. That's exactly what our adversaries are pursuing, partly because they know it's a weakness of ours, that we've always been planning these traditional battles. And we know we can win many of those traditional battles, but we aren't even sure what to do when a scenario like the one you just described pops up. I mean, another great example is NATO. I think that this is a place where there's an interesting partisan divide. Most Republicans that I know in Congress support NATO and they want to see it maintained. That may be a place of difference with the president. But when the president says that NATO is outdated, there is a little bit of truth to that because Russia's attacking our NATO allies and ourselves through the internet every day. And that it simply wasn't written into the 1949 Charter of NATO how to deal with cyber attacks, you know, for obvious reasons. But if NATO is going to be relevant in the 21st century, we've got to modernize it to the point where we say, you know, how are you going to deal with this? So a few conclusions that we come to in the report are that, yes, this gray zone conflict is real. we've got to be pretty better prepared for it, both in terms of how we train our troops, but in terms of just the general operational concepts that we study at the Department of Defense. And we also have to modernize our alliances. Alliances are important, yes, but we can't simply strengthen the alliances that we have. We have to modernize them for a new world.
Maybe I'll pick up there, Congressman Banks, and ask you a question about alliances. And again, I really like the way the report talked about making a distinction between partnerships, alliances, and a distinction also between reinventing alliances versus simply expanding them. Something that's been, again, a pet peeve of mine is that it's become almost de rigueur to say that NATO should expand, that this has become a bipartisan clarion call since the end of the Cold War. I've been of the view that this has been not necessarily in our American interest to keep this going indefinitely. And I like the fact that the report asks some tough questions about whether NATO should in fact expand. I also, because I have my doubts personally, I also wonder, some people say we should think about alliances someday, let's say with Vietnam or India, but I worry that locks us into obligations to go fight on the Eurasian mainland when maybe we're better off with stronger partnerships that don't obligate us, but allow us to be more flexible. And that may also be a more realistic way, in particular with India, which doesn't seem to be clamoring for an alliance with the United States anytime soon. So am I reading you correctly on the way in which you're making these distinctions between alliances and partnerships, and anything more you want to say about that?
Maybe just a little bit. I talked about Huawei a little bit ago. We can't fight back against Huawei if all of our strongest allies are adopting Huawei without strains on our relationships abroad. And this is why these alliances matter. This is why our relationships with our NATO allies, especially in the fight against Huawei, is so significant. And it's why we've taken, a strong bipartisan statement and approach in the report that, in some ways, I concur with my friend Seth on the other side of the aisle that contrasts some with the current administration. And we dared to do that in the report because we believe it matters. If we look further abroad, Seth and I took a trip as part of our task force effort to Southeast Asia. And we got a true taste, I think, in a short period of time of how strained our relationships with China's closest neighbors are, and how complicated it will be moving forward to counter the China threat when we have strained relationships with countries like Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia, especially, who we visited specifically. Those relationships matter, and an approach from a generation before that we've taken with NATO is the same approach that we should take with entities like ASEAN in Asia to try to build better relationships and rapport with those partners that we'll need to fight back against a
May have lost your audio a bit on that last sentence, if you don't mind repeating it, Congressman, please.
I probably repeated myself too much already, but my point was that if we're going to fight back against a rising China, we need stronger partnerships with China's closest neighbors, especially in Southeast Asia. And I found and was educated through this task force about how important ASEAN can be as a powerful entity to rally our allies in that region to counter a rising China. I don't know if Seth has more to say, but I found that particular trip, in addition to our trip to Silicon Valley, to be pivotal experiences that truly shaped and defined the end result of this task force report.
Jim's absolutely right. And that probably, if I had to pick one part of the world that most urgently needs our attention, it's probably Southeast Asia. We actually saw something very similar in Africa, which is far from China geographically, but a real focus of Chinese expansion. And the United States is not really presenting an alternative, even though there are an awful lot of African nations and leaders that would prefer to have a U.S. alternative. So Jim's exactly right. And, you know, just to go back to the premise of your question, Mike, for a second, it's kind of interesting that You said, okay, I understand that having a partnership with a country like India might be important, but I don't want to be tied into a commitment on the ground there. You know, if you think about the foundation of NATO, I mean, NATO was fundamentally established to prevent Russia from rolling into Germany, right? And it has not been able to deal with Russia infiltrating Germany through the internet every single day. Well, in the same vein, you know, we might want to pursue a partnership, an alliance with India that is very strong on preventing Chinese cyber intrusion into India, and likewise steps up our defenses against Chinese cyber intrusion, but is not necessarily focused on preventing a land war in Asia, because that's not really what's in our national security interest right now. So that's the kind of innovative thinking that we need to bring to really refashioning our alliances for a totally new world, a new world of threats.
In the report, you at one point used the phrase or the term existential to talk about the stakes. And of course, Jim Mattis, who had a flair for the dramatic, and we all enjoyed and benefited from his tenure as Secretary of Defense, he talked about how this might be an expensive national defense strategy, but the country can afford survival because the stakes are so high. I wonder, what's a worst case scenario for each of you that can sort of illustrate what you mean when you say that the stakes here are existential? Because I think some people may wonder, you know, at a time when we don't see a communist expansionist threat, you know, and we don't see China threatening to invade Japan or the, you know, Korea, in what sense are the stakes existential? Understanding that they're important, but to what extent could they really threaten our core security or that of our most important allies? I wonder if you could just flesh that out a little bit, maybe each of you, starting with Congressman Banks.
Yeah, let me go back for a moment, Michael, to our experience in Southeast Asia, where we saw this battle between democracy versus authoritarianism more clearly than maybe I've ever seen before in my life, where countries that have been traditional allies of the United States of America are being coerced by China to choose China's interest over the interest of the free world and of the United States of America. That's what's at stake. And I think I won't speak for Seth, but when I'm thinking about the existential threat, that's what I'm thinking about more clearly than ever before, because China has figured out how to leverage their relationships in a way that has been more productive for them. Keeping in mind that their goals are very different than our goals. We seek America as a force for good around the world. China's interest around the globe is China's interest. And China's tentacles are spread out further around the globe than they ever have been before. And they're coercing their relationships to benefit their interest and their interest to dominate the United States of America specifically. So that's the existential threat that we face. If we don't do something about it now, before it's too late, then I fear what the next generation is going to look like for my children, for Seth's children, for the future of America. That's what this report tries to strike at, I think, and did so in a powerful way.
You know, Mike, you talked about Secretary Mattis. I served under General Mattis in the Marine Corps, and he may have a flair for the dramatic, but it's always grounded in reality. It's always one of those flares where you say, wow, that really hit home. But yes, it's quite true. That's exactly what's going on. And I think that's what we try to do with this report too. It's the last two findings. We have 11 findings. Number 10 and 11 are I think quite interesting on this point, because we just come out and say authoritarianism is on the rise globally, whereas democracy is waning. So we're not just warning about this. We're saying, we're losing this race today. Today, we're losing this race, partly because we're not engaged enough in places like Jim just described in Southeast Asia, where China is forcing these countries to make this choice. And look, America is not perfect, but we're very different than China. We are a country that's fundamentally based on freedom, on independence, and an open society. And that's exactly the opposite of what China is all about. So this is a competition, excuse me, that's playing out today. And The final conclusion, the final finding that we make is that the United States is most likely to succeed by playing to our strengths, a free, fair, and open economy, strong education system, and a culture for innovation that rests on the open market and free democratic principles. You know, in some ways, it's kind of striking that we just had to say that, that we had to set out in a bipartisan way that these basic foundational principles of our country are still how we should be pursuing this this competition and winning this race. Because obviously, world events have called that into doubt.
So in the 10 minutes we have left, I'd like to raise a couple more topics. And one is the question which you address in the report of the authorization on the use of military force, the congressional legislation, the law passed shortly after 9/11 that has governed our broader exposure and activity in the Middle East ever since. And you have a concern in the report that we should update this, which a number of people have said, but often the devil is in the details. How do you update this? And I wondered if you wanted to speak to that question, as well as the broader question of whether we are still sort of over-invested and over-deployed in the broader Middle East. Obviously, people like you two and Congressman Moltz and you in particular, I know how much time you spent in Iraq. A lot of people in service would love to be free of the Middle East. It just tends to be a strategic quicksand that draws us back. And at the moment, we've got, you know, a few thousand troops in Afghanistan, a few thousand in Iraq, a few thousand here, a few thousand there. The footprint is more modest than it was a decade or two ago, or I should say a decade or 15 years ago. It's bigger than it was in the 1990s, but it's much smaller than it was at the peak of the Iraq and Afghanistan operations. Do we need to rethink that, or is it at least trending in the right direction? Over to both of you on that, maybe starting with Congressman Banks, if I could.
We remain overextended in parts of the world that prevent us from devoting the attention and the resources that it will take to confront the greater threats that we face for the generation to come. The devil is in the details. What I think is important and powerful about the AUMF recommendation in this report is that in my 4 years in Congress, I found that Congress's head is in the sand. Congress doesn't want to confront these issues, and forcing Congress to update the AUMF, whatever the details end up emerging from that, I mean, I can hardly guess where that debate will lead or what an updated AUMF might look like. It will force Congress to do its job and get its head out of the sand and focus on the realities that this report brings to light in a way that I haven't seen anyone else bring to light at this point, 4 years into my term in Congress.
Excellent.
Jim's exactly right. I would just add a little bit to that by talking for a second about what an incredibly talented panel we had in going after this. And Jim obviously brings a tremendous wealth of experience. He's done a lot in a few years in Congress, not to mention his service in the Navy. But we also have Mike Walls, the first United States Special Forces soldier elected to Congress. Scott Desjarlais has a tremendous perspective, not as a veteran, but as someone who's been on the Armed Services Committee for a while, but is fundamentally a doctor. And Paul Mitchell is from the private sector. On my side of the aisle, we've got Susan Davis, who's one of the most senior members of the Armed Services Committee, and Chrissy Houlihan and Alyssa Slotkin are both veterans in different ways. Chrissy from the Air Force, Alyssa from the CIA and the Department of Defense. And if you think about this group as a whole, we have a perspective, a lot of veterans, a lot of people who've been engaged in these conflicts very directly, but also people who come to Congress where politics wasn't their whole career. You know, they were very successful. Like Paul Mitchell is very successful in the private sector. And he brings this real private sector sensibility to the work that we do in Congress. And he was actually one of the ones who really drove this AUMF point and said, Congress has got to do its job. You got to stop playing politics with something so fundamental as our national security and live up to your constitutional obligation to make these decisions, not put your head in the sand, like Jim just said, but make these decisions, take this responsibility for putting our young men and women in harm's way and fundamentally protecting the country. If Congress were more serious about that and having a conversation amongst ourselves and with the American people about these commitments, both the existing commitments we have where young men and women today and tonight are stationed all around the globe in dangerous places, but also the commitments that we have to make to ensure the future of our national security, we would be much more successful. Congress has got to do that job.
So you naturally led me to my last question, which will give you both an opportunity to wrap up with any concluding comments as well, and which builds on some of what we've heard from the audience. People are, you know, challenging not so much you two, but the Congress writ large to say, how can this happen if Congress protects legacy systems, if Congress protects bases, if Congress resists defense reform, and especially in the context, come back to the earlier point of where defense budgets may not be growing any longer, and therefore we have to find a way to make do with less. You've both said that the overall top line doesn't strike you as the most important concern, but nonetheless, if we really go from having aspired to 3-5% annual real growth indefinitely into the future, which was what was being called for and hoped for a couple of years ago, to a world now of absolutely flat or even slightly declining budgets, it does raise the question of how we're going to find enough money. So I just wondered, I guess the question to then quote what I'm getting from the audience, the question really to put a point on it is can we really do what you're asking for in the task force report if Congress doesn't change the way it's doing its own business, not only on AUMF, but more generally on how it allocates budgetary priorities and how, you know, it's willing to be a little less parochial in its role in the defense debate. I don't mean to be rude. I'm just quoting the questions. And again, the questions were not posed in a rude way. They were recognizing you were just two members out of 535 in the overall Congress. But I think it's a good place maybe to finish. So over to you for an answer to that and any final thoughts you want to leave us with, starting with Congressman Moulton.
Well, let me begin my answer by citing two very well-respected Republicans, both veterans, one of whom, Dwight Eisenhower, warned us over 50 years ago, over almost 70 years ago, about the threat of a military-industrial complex and the danger that that would be to the United States of America, not just to our freedom and values, but ultimately to our national security itself. And then Senator John McCain revised his statement a bit by saying it's not just a military-industrial complex, it's the military-industrial-congressional complex that we have to be worried about. And they're absolutely right. This is a real concern. This is the threat that we face. In many ways, a lot of the conclusions that we come to this into this report won't be totally out in left field or right field, won't be totally revolutionary for some of the people who follow this issue very closely. We know that we need to invest more in quantum computing and AI. Might not have appreciated the importance of biotech or whatnot. But I think in some ways, two of the most important things about this task force and the conclusions that we've reached are, number one, that we've said this isn't a race that we might lose. This is a race that right now, today, we are losing. And if that does anything to appropriately strike fear in the minds of American citizens, but also of our colleagues in Congress, I hope we're successful there. That's the truth, but it's a hard truth to hear. And the second thing is that we've come to these truths in a fully bipartisan way. So this isn't just some outside think tank, as important as they are in coming to these conclusions. This is a group of members of Congress from both sides of the aisle, from many different districts and perspectives, backgrounds and experiences, who have all come together to say, yes, these threats are real. We are losing this race right now. And the only way that we can succeed is if we make very dramatic changes to how we're approaching our national security. So I think that's one of the most important things to take away from this discussion this morning, Mike, is that, you know, we've heard some of these ideas before, but to have it come out of a truly bipartisan commission in Congress obviously took some political courage among the members here. But hopefully that can serve as an example to other members of Congress to truly make the changes that we need to make to ensure our national security.
Fantastic. And Congressman Banks, over to you for the final word.
That was really well put by Seth. I'll just add, I heard a story last week by a former McCain staffer who said that Senator McCain would huddle with his staff on a weekly basis and talk about their priorities, what they were working on, talk about national defense issues, and said that when the senator would leave the room, he would look back at his staff and he would chant reform, 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 right? That was his mantra. I don't know if Seth and I can change the mindset of Congress or the Pentagon, but I know we sure as hell don't have a choice but to try. And this report lays out the reasons for that. Senator McCain, a great legacy of reform. I also think of my colleague, retiring former chairman and ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, Mac Thornberry, who's devoted his career in Congress to especially the types of acquisition reforms and Pentagon reforms that it's going to take to get there. Now Seth and I, as two younger, newer members of Congress, we have a charge set out for us that this report lays out, I think, very well of where we go from here.
Let me just say myself how much it's been a privilege to host this event. And while we're mentioning people who have been inspirational to us, let me mention another great Hoosier, Alice Rivlin, who we lost last year, Congressman Banks, but who was one of the great budget and fiscal thinkers of our country, but also very pragmatic on how to balance and protect key national priorities across the full range of interests. I don't want to make any prognostications about where the defense budget is headed, but I think she would be gratified to know you're both trying to be fiscally conscious as you think about all these priorities as well. But it's really been a pleasure and privilege for me. Thank you for the report. I know it's available in a number of locations, but again, this is the Future of Defense Task Force of the House Armed Services Committee that we've been hearing about today. So with thanks to all who joined, especially to you two, best wishes.